This is episode 17 of The Brilliant.
I prefer to stick to my gun.
We live in a world where most stories are just variants of the same story. Good beats evil, cowboys and Indians, profits and loss. This story has been told 1,000,000,000 times, and the ubiquity of it is what I would call a great tragedy, because of the consequences it's had on our imagination and our capacity to be more. The Brilliant Podcast attempts to tell stories about the brilliant ones, the ones who lived human-sized lives that may seem larger than life. The ones who dream beyond recognition. The ones who are satisfied not answering every question that critics ask and just living in the contradiction. This is an attempt to tell different kinds of stories. Ones with complex moral plays. Ones that aren't so clearly stories. And ones that are of human size. I am your host, Aragorn, joined by co-host Bellamy, and in the background, our sound engineer, Roy Burton. So we have a lot to talk about again this week, and I have some disruptions that should annoy Bellamy,
the best laid plans of mice and men.
Yeah, exactly. So why don't we begin with your thoughts on the outline of what we're going to do this week?
Oh yeah, okay. So the illusion that I'm under is that we're going to talk a bit about the topic of the week. We might touch on the Schmidt incident, but I don't know if I care that much. There was some hubbub from my very own college of origin in the mainstream news this week. And we may touch on a new media project that came out of some folks that are operating out of New York. And then toward the end, we're going to spend a while talking about the book Desert, which I just read over the past 2 days, and I'd been familiar with it for a while, but never actually read it, and we're going to talk about that and what the implications are, and I had some criticisms of it as well.
So what's the theme this week?
What is the theme this week? I thought we were trying to break out of the theme paradigm, actually.
Sure, in terms of the titling, that's true.
Yeah. I guess the theme is...
ATR?
There is no real theme after joining things.
So we'll begin with news, which I guess we'll talk a little bit about the topic of the week.
So the topic of the week was the social and the political.
For those of you who aren't familiar, the topic of the week, when we refer to it, is usually the anarchist news topic of is always the anarchist news topic of the week, which is a weekly segment that basically seems to inspire quite a bit of conversation. And has been a nice running theme in the anarchist news. And this week it's, the problem with friendship or
I think it was titled The Social and the Political, but the prompt is basically, I'm assuming it's a reference to Tikkun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how Tikkun several years ago indicted the idea of existing in the milieu.
Mm-hmm.
And that instead there should be a turn away from that to friendship as the place where the meat of politics exists. And then so the prompt was sort of, does this have weight, and what are the implications of friendship?
There's also an insurrectionary origin to this. I would say that mostly in the writings of Wolfie Landstreicher, he sort of speaks to this. I mean, it's fuzzy, but it's something about relationships based on affinity,
right?
And that mostly conflates into a politics based on friendship.
I always thought that was kind of a funny thing, because affinity on the face of it means that you have, I guess, to me, it's always been a bit funny, the divisions between projectuality, affinity, and friendship, right? Mm-hmm. Because affinity being basically a commonality of belief or commonality of analysis or that sort of thing, which might be friends or might not. I mean, I have plenty of friends who are not anarchists, and I would even consider doing certain sorts of projects with them if they had those same interests, and we might not have the same goals or the same orientation at all. And so when there are debates on friendship versus milieu versus affinity versus projectuality, the lines are not so clear, and that's why to me the projectuality seems the cleanest and easiest, because it really is something that is revisable, and you can look and have a clear metric of, is this project working or not? Hmm. And if it's not, then maybe I don't want, then something needs to be fixed, or I don't want to be involved in it. It's not really about, do I get along with these people, or do we really have the same analysis, or do we?
Yeah, I think that what you're saying is true and great, and I think that this is a place where terminology tends to be clearer than what I see in practice. I see in practice that people make tons of exceptions for people who they consider their friends. Mm-hmm. And then will even describe friendship as being affinity when it is not necessarily. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times, even in political friendships, you don't actually talk about how you got to where you are. You just sort of assume that you all agree and carry on.
As far as analysis, you mean, or as far as...
Yeah, as far as analysis, as far as position. Uh-huh. I mean, I perhaps see this conversation very differently than most people. Because of my lifelong sobriety, friendship and affinity do end up being very different characteristics for me in a way that I think a lot of people, they're not. I tend to see people who party together call that friendship. Mm-hmm. And then conflate it with affinity. Mm-hmm. And
there was an interesting comment on the A News thread that I'm going to read and see what you think about. Mm-hmm. It. A problem with friendship as being the basis for organizing is that it leads to clusters of friends forming cliques or cliques, depending on your preference. These cliques then dominate an anarchist scene, and those people who are unable to make friends with these people joining the clique are left excluded from the anarchist scene, looking in from the outside. It reminded me of other complaints that appeared on A News about it, A News just being an extension of a certain Bay Area in crowd. Mm-hmm. And that it just plugs those projects and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's a funny topic. I mean, just to talk about the meta topic that you're referring to. As someone associated with Anarchist News, which, you know, is fair to say, I've absolutely always felt as though Anarchist News was an outsider project looking in. And
outsider project looking in, by which you mean?
By which I mean on the back of every Crime Think publication for 10 to 15 years, was advertisements for Infoshop.org, even after Infoshop.org had totally abandoned anarchism as a news project.
You're saying rather than A News.
Right. In other words, no other project other than ones that I've been associated with have ever really plugged anarchist news in a meaningful way. But CrimeThink, which is absolutely not associated with Infoshop, has advertised Infoshop as a sort of neutral news ground in a way that they never did Anarchist News. And I just mentioned that one because it's the most crass example of a mass project that advertised someone else's project. But all of the sort of like no substantial or no major anarchist project has ever plugged Anarchist News.
Mm-hmm. Because it's seen as something that unseemly to be associated with.
And that's because of the comments.
Right.
And so to me, this speaks to a sick, twisted thing where an open commenting platform is seen as being an in-crowd and clicky, whereas the blandest or the mass project of Infoshop, which nobody uses as a communication platform is seen as non-sectarian, or like, it's a topsy-turvy world where basically I think that I totally recognize where this comment is coming from, but that the meta point I think is utterly bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the funny thing about Anarchist News is that the fact that certain things don't get removed are seen as somehow this is what the moderators want, even if it's something totally wackadoodle like the recent the Nazis didn't really gas anyone thing that was happening, which is just bizarre.
I mean, honestly, if I were it's always this very it's an interesting and challenging problem, because to start with, people don't recognize where the problem is. They name it incorrectly. Of course, the problem isn't that the moderators are pro certain comments and con other comments. It's much more a case where who wants to, like, I used to say to people that I would read every comment of Anarchist News, but usually what that meant, especially if the comments were longer than a few words or uninteresting to me, which the vast majority of the comments are uninteresting to me, it means that I would scan them for the 7 deadly words. And if they didn't exist, if they weren't the 7 deadly words, no names were used, I'd move on to the next thing. And I think that especially when you start to talk about parody and irony and any sort of nuanced sort of arguments, like, what you have to do to actually follow through and go down the tunnel of understanding the context of a comment so that you can delete it correctly, it's extremely, it's excruciatingly difficult. So
it gets into a certain time dump logic.
Right.
Yeah.
Where that whole conversation leads to is, though, the decision that led to the formation of It's Going Down.
Right.
Because at the end of that conversation, you can basically say, are we committed to having an open forum to talk about difficult topics, or are we not committed to that, and we don't think that the internet is a place for that, and therefore we basically want to abandon comments entirely? And I absolutely understand the motivation for abandoning comments entirely. But if you're going to talk about a click problem, you've locked in the click problem when you do that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, this person's comment wasn't about Andy specifically. Making it clear to the listeners.
I mean, and if we're going to be really clear about that comment, the comment about clicks, let's talk about the fact that any time that my name is used on Anarchist News, it absolutely becomes a party of usually through 3 or 4 plus people talking about how terrible I am.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of like the inverse rule of cliquishness within anarchism, is that the more well known you are as a person, the more you just become a target for harassment.
Mm-hmm. So I did want to talk about whether there was any sort of weight to this comment in general. I guess my response to the person would be, sure. I mean, clicks happen, and that's just sort of basic monkey behavior, and it sucks if you want to get involved in a project and it feels like it's the cool kids or something like that, but it's... The alternative seems to be what a sort of formal organizational structure where it's more like going to a job and
I've never heard of a formal organization that wasn't clicky.
Right. Yeah. Then you've just institutionalized the clickiness.
Yeah. And again, to play devil's advocate I sort of see myself as inhabiting this position more than I'm not. In other words, the sort of feeling like an outsider, feeling like you're seeing the cool kids play and that they're not inviting you in. I've always felt that was my position. And the only time in which that's ever changed, and I wouldn't say that it's necessarily changed myself, I feel in there somehow a criticism of myself, but I personally don't think it's all that fair. What I would say is that... it is extremely socially challenging to feel like you're on the outside of a clique. It just is.
Yeah.
And so our challenge within the anarchist space is to allow several different ways of entry, and that's, you know, a really big challenge. So in the context of let's say a newswire like Anarchist News, you know, the other way in which you can participate is to make the news,
right?
Or to write the essay that you submit anonymously. And to me, it feels like a lot of the sort of like people who are not socially apt, that's the way in which they have found that they participate.
Mm-hmm.
But clicks that especially are really dominant in a location. So, for instance, the reading group click in the Bay Area, it might be well known and it might feel like a click, but it doesn't feel like it dominates the Bay Area,
no.
Right?
Yeah.
Whereas there's another click that you could sort of refer to as the Oakland Commune. That's much more a dominating click, but you know, at the core of the Oakland Commune is a type of, you know, not supposed to call it activism, that if you're not that into that sort of activism, you don't really belong there in the first place. And if you do believe in the activism, you sort of can have a relationship to that clique that isn't maybe the one you want, but you can have a relationship to that clique.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a challenge what you were saying with making the anarchist space inviting, because of course a lot of people do want to join anarchist spaces in order to have friends, because they understandably, as we've talked about, a lot of, you know, probably most of the anarchists in the country don't live in the coastal cities.
Sure.
And we've gone through this sort of theme of the person who feels isolated, feels like they can't have these conversations. And so it's understandable that people want to be around people who at least they can have certain kinds of conversations about the emptiness of everyday life and all that sort of thing. So I guess what I'm getting at then is, when you said it's a challenge to make these sorts of when you said it's a challenge to make this sort of space inviting, I mean, I don't know what the way in is, really, besides trying to join in some sort of project, and I don't know that there should be other ways in.
Yeah.
I don't know that there should be this inviting queer Bay Area party crowd, and that's the way into anarchism, because that's going to bring in the very sort of transitive scene sort of person.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it isn't becoming genuine friends and therefore being in on the click, or it's not doing a project and then perhaps having friends that way, then I don't know how to make anarchism inviting besides those ways.
Yeah, I think it's a hard problem, but it's a problem that can't be solved from the top down anyways. Mm-hmm. So this conversation, we can muse on the point,
mm-hmm.
but...
You want to move on?
Yeah. Let's skip that.
Okay. So my own alma mater, Oberlin College, came into the news this week, and I was amused. The controversy was that over banh mi and sushi... Cafeteria was serving banh mi, which, for those who don't know, is a Vietnamese sandwich that's a French baguette, pork, pickled vegetables, fresh herbs, and pâté. And the college served what they called banh mi, but it was ciabatta, pork, and coleslaw. And this was called culturally appropriative and racist. And another incident a short while later was that there was some sushi that was apparently poorly made sushi, and this was called racist because it was giving a poor representation of Japanese food and was possibly giving the impression to many students that Japanese food is not good. And
and this made you have feelings.
This made me have feelings that were... apparently the students who were upset about it were very quickly given an audience with the school administration, who summarily apologized and took notes on how they could do a better job in the future. And to me, the feeling was just that accusation culture, as we've talked about in the anarchist scene, is I think you called it a time-saving device. It's a way to basically say, fuck you, now you have to either leave or make amends to me. And we see that it is now more and more part of college campus culture and has worked its way outside of radical circles. And I guess to me, one might think that when something gets picked up by the mainstream, that it would be a sign that it was a toxic tendency and it was something that was very easily recuperated. And I'm curious to see now that more and more it's present on campus culture and it's being talked about and it's being mocked, or at least if
conservative commentators.
Not just conservatives, though.
Sure.
More and more, even in these sorts of mainstream publications like the, or mainstream, I'm sorry, liberal publications like The Atlantic are saying this is a problem for our youth. I'm just curious to see whether it has ramifications on accusation culture within the radical circle to say, like, oh, if college kids are doing it over this sort of silly shit, then perhaps it was never something so radical in the first place.
Well, there's two directions I want to take this in, because I do think that there's some deep stuff in here. One, I grew up in the Midwest, and Ohio is the Midwest, whether you like it or not. The people who work in the cafeterias are not the students. Mm-hmm. The student body tends to come from an upper middle class of Oberlin, tends to come from an upper middle class, sometimes Midwest, but sometimes coastal population. In other words, the student body does not reflect the area where Oberlin College lives.
Not in the least. I should mention that that there's a minority of students who are there, like with heavy scholarships and such, but the majority of students that are not are paying the full tuition, which is huge. So, I mean, this is definitely a upper middle class or above.
Right. But where I was going is being raised in the Midwest and having eaten a lot of cafeteria type food from the Midwest, the idea that a Midwestern institution, there isn't ethnic food that hasn't been adulterated by the Midwestern cafeteria experience. I am shocked that Italian people have not risen in mass against the offenses that Midwestern cafeterias have done to their food. So that list could go on and on. But of course, Oberlin being Oberlin isn't just going to offend European food tastes, but it's going to go further. And so to me, that whole concept of just treating a cafeteria as responsible for the cultural expression of anyone is just mind-boggling. Really,
I mean, there's so many levels to it. I mean, the class divide level, like as in, I accuse, I am offended as I, have this incredibly rich education that's rich as in cost. And I also expect what I'm assuming are minimum wage workers to be providing me with culturally authentic food is just incredible.
Yeah. So I also want to talk about the two different senses of the word liberal.
Uh-huh.
So there's, when you mention Atlantic being a liberal publication, I agree with you, but I feel like the use of the term liberal that you were using was the other use of the term. So the two different terms I would use for the word liberal as we usually use it is that there's a liberal sort of that's seen as sort of like a soft Democrat political position. And when we accuse someone within the anarchist space of being liberal, usually that's what we mean, sort of a soft Bernie Sanders supporter.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second use would be liberal, capital L, liberal education,
right.
and sort of the liberal tradition, post-Enlightenment, blah, 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 blah. And sure. So to me, Atlantic is a publication of the capital L liberal rather than Mother Jones, which I would say is a publication of the soft liberal.
Okay.
I mean, we may disagree, but so the Atlantic for a couple years now has been talking a lot about the decline of the liberal education and publications like the Atlantic. And this to me feels like a piece in the series that they're working on where they're talking about the decimation of the liberal education in the American university system. And this story does really remind me of the kind of story that you'd expect to see on Fox News talking about how, in their case, what they're doing is their job is to conflate the liberal education or the, learning the standards of European thought with soft liberalism, Bernie Sanders supporters, right. Blue state
and
bullshit.
To say that it's that one necessarily leads to the decadence of the other.
Right. But there is something, there is something going on here that is sort of interesting, which is this idea of the people who are allegedly the most in support of a liberal to radical political position are doing this sort of work that is absolutely just fodder for the establishment right.
The students.
Yeah,
absolutely. What was funny too was seeing that an alumnus who was actually someone that was in my, I knew this person, wrote a short article for The Atlantic saying, I went to the school, and sure, it's easy to make fun of these kids, but what we have to think about is this is what they're doing right now when they're 19, and these are stepping stones, and they're leading them to more authentic activism in the future.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, to see this as some sort of, you know,
baby step.
Step in the process.
Yeah. Yeah.
You start by fighting the cafeteria, and then you fight.
Well, I mean, I think that their point is true, but it's maybe a slightly different point.
Well, I think their point could be true, but to me, it suggests it's only going to lead you into more, you know, awful mutations of
this. Right? No, exactly. Yeah, I think that would be where I would go too. I mean, it's hard to not bring up the example of Van Jones, who, if you didn't know, was, I guess, in the White House, in the organization of the White House, there's the cabinet, and then there's sort of like a sub-cabinet. And so Van Jones was in the sub-cabinet, and his position was something like Czar of Green Jobs or something, okay. Something in that zone.
But this is recent.
Well, early Obama White House.
Okay.
He was shit-canned 3 or 4 years into Obama's first term, because basically he probably should never have been in anywhere around this level of politics in the first place. The reason that we know about him here in the Bay Area is he specifically was involved in this group called Storm, which was a Maoist Oakland group that absolutely survived on these sort of controversies that we're sort of talking about. And yeah, and so Van Jones was the leader of this, and then sort of converted whatever the projects were that they did before into focusing on green jobs and green economic positions, and then climbed really quickly.
Wow!
Yeah, he's worth reading about.
It's amazing
because he exemplified. You know, he did lots of.
I'm just surprised his Maoist background didn't come up at some point during the vetting process.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about Maoism is that a lot of its terminology can easily turn into terms like community. So a lot of Storm's work was that they were a community group. If you look at their website today or try to research them, you'll see lots of like education, community, and people of color faces on their mastheads. And for those, like, lots of radicals in the Bay Area know about Van because Storm was a player in East Bay politics for the past 20 years. And as a matter of fact, it was a descendant of Storm. I think we talked about the 9/11 meeting.
During
a prior podcast. It was one of the descendants of Storm's organizational units that actually came to the 9/11 meeting. And
read the really long document.
So very much a player in our world, you know, but just a couple of steps away, but also then just a couple of steps away from the White House, from the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, anyway, that was just my little story about that, because I was at Oberlin from 2006 to 2010, and you could definitely start to feel that kind of presence there when I was there, which was the first time I encountered that kind of thing, as I talked about the other week, and it seems to have only increased since then. But shall we talk about the video?
Listen!
So there's a video from the group Woodbine, who are the American Tikkunists operating out of New York City proper, yeah?
Yeah, they're in a neighborhood called Woodbine, but that's somewhere between the Bronx and Brooklyn.
Okay.
It's like a little bubble.
Yeah. And they released a 6 or 7 minute film this week that very much feels like a movie trailer.
It's called...
Resolution.
Yeah. Or maybe a resolution.
Yeah, not to be confused. It very much has the kind of feel of the movie trailer where the shot is changing every few seconds and there's music that starts slow and spacious and heavy and gradually becomes more intense. And the structure of it is a little bit like the Crime Thing to Change Everything video where there's several different readers.
Very similar.
Interacting with each other and finishing each other's sentences. And the whole thrust of it is to say basically, we know things are really bad. We know things are really bad. This is something we know in the everyday. There's some shots of melting glaciers. There's shots of people rising up in a more or less vague way. And then partway through it switches to, but we are the people and we are strong, and there are people feeding each other and making bread. And then at the end of it, it's Happy New Year, which is very strange.
Well, I mean, obviously, by titling it a resolution, they're right. Framing it in terms of the
but it's as if to say, now it's time for you to become
2016
an anti-state communist, and we're going to build the commune. But
well, actually, it's nothing like that. I mean, what it says is for freedom. That's its rallying cry at the very end, and then, I mean, we'll talk about all this later. But and then they punctuate it with a insane howler.
Yeah,
but
there are a number of howlers.
But in terms of their political manifesto, though, the only thing they say, there's no mention of Tikkun. There's no mention of any of this gobbledygook that we talk about all the time. They basically boil it right down to its core unit, which is for freedom.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to be against freedom.
No,
they're hard to disagree with.
They're for it, yeah. I'm not sure who would disagree with...
Well, that's why I'm saying it's one of the most open-ended, inviting things you can say. Right?
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, on that level, I kind of envy the particular math that they use to write this and to put this together.
Lowest common denominator being the math that you're
referring
to?
But it's not... Or? I mean, this is an example of people who have a...
There's nothing in there that takes a difficult position, or there's nothing in there that... is disagreeable.
That's not my point.
Okay.
My point is that these are college-educated people making a series of calculations about what the lowest common denominator is.
Okay.
How in the hell would the lowest common denominator find this thing?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, at one point in it, it sort of mentions how much we have in common and shows a picture of a soccer game going on. The soccer game is not... There's no Molotovs in the soccer field. It's just a shot of a sport that most Americans are not into, other than cool Americans or Americans who are immigrants from a different country. And in other words, it's a classic academic snapshot on what they think is mass culture.
Yeah. Wait, so when you were saying you kind of envy the math...
Well, I envy the fact that they did all the calculations that one would do to determine what all these mass sweet spots are.
Okay.
And then they implement them. Like, they demonstrate what it looks like to implement all this sort of calculation. And from looking at it, I just can't imagine it working and on the level that they're trying to work on at all.
Yeah. Well, the other question that you brought up is, what is the distribution? How are they trying to get it out there?
Right. I mean, the way I found it is Mask Magazine. Mask, yeah. And the idea of Mask Magazine being your conduit to a population that you want to reach is very bizarre. Perhaps in the New York area, they have different, sort of similar but different ways in which people would access it. Because I guarantee, you know, me as a working person who... you know, just lives my life, I wouldn't find this video.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and this was similar to Change Everything. You know, when because I pay a lot of attention to social media and I try to like at least see sort of how, you know, these sort of things move through the landscape. You know, to Change Everything obviously really wanted to get like a million Facebook likes. You know, there's 1,000 stupid memes that get a million, you know, whatever fucking retweets or whatever in the fuck. And
like Pelican Eats Pigeon.
Sure. And so to me, you know, the success of this project on its own terms is whether it breaks that bubble.
Yeah.
And so like if this gets retweeted by Mother Jones, right, that has 1,000 liberal, you know, tens of thousands of liberals that pay attention to it, or The Nation, or The Atlantic,
right,
then it's succeeded on its own terms.
Yeah.
And as it stands, the fact that you and I are talking about it, and you know, I personally know some of the core people involved in producing this video, that's not success. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mask Magazine, you know, has hundreds of subscribers, not thousands. Perhaps I'm wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's funny to compare the two because, of course, to Change Everything, I mean, they physically traveled all around the country and visited,
But their video was prior to that.
Okay, sure, yeah. sure. Yeah, I guess, you know, I'm left wondering, what does Woodbine want? I mean, do they want a bunch of people locally to see this and join their particular project?
Right.
Are they trying to inspire other similar projects around? Yeah, it was hard to understand. I guess, as with the To Change Everything video, maybe less so with the document, it is difficult for me to understand the whole thrust of these things because they contain almost no content. I mean, there's no political critique in them. It's all rhetoric and imagery and some kind of, you know, feeling of like, oh man, things are bad, but we can do things.
Definitely and, intentional.
Yeah, but then, so what is... It is intentional,
yeah.
But then what is the goal then? Is it just to vaguely make someone say, oh, I should look at this Woodbine thing? Like, is that success if someone then...
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I definitely don't know the answer to that question. I think it's an interesting one. If I were to hazard a guess, I would say that it harkens back to that old situationist slogan that basically is something along the lines of, what we are saying is already on everybody else's lips.
Uh-huh.
And so that's very much, it feels like there's something in here, like a lot of radicals critique meme culture because, you know, it's silly or it's goofy or whatever. But this is where I think radicals are totally wrong. Meme culture is an expression of a thing that's on everybody's mind. And so that's very much the terrain that this feels like it's playing on.
So you don't need to provide the content because the content is already implicit or it's latent. The political critique is latent in the audience, and so all you need to do is activate it and make them feel like... Actually, make them feel like they're not alone. One of the lines in the video was, you are not alone.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, when I look at some of the more public projects that they've done, they wrote this piece of propaganda called Nomos that came out around the 350 march in New York City, the environmental march.
Yeah.
And the imagery on the propaganda was an iceberg. So they're clearly really doubling down on climate change as being the terrain that they want to live on, and they handed out tens of thousands of copies of this piece of literature, and
to the marchers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that they are trying to live in this terrain because I'm not sure that they would have the organizational know-how or the interest in tens of thousands of people coming to their space and saying, we're ready.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that they would have all that clear of answers to those people if they did show up.
Mm-hmm.
But probably they are. I mean, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess I was just trying to make inferences from Tikkun in general to say that they must be trying to grow the commune. That must be the purpose of this. But
well, I mean, that's a different conversation that I don't want to speak too much of private information I have.
Mm.
But my sense would be that they think that other people should be doing the same work that they're doing more than they want people to join their work.
Okay, so then, yeah, then that does make me think it's more the other thing I said, that maybe they want to inspire other people to create similar groups elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that that's fair.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And there were howlers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The biggest howler of all, which was honestly just struck me as crazy and makes the whole thing retrospectively seem like parody for a moment. One of the last lines is, "The Force will be with you always."
Yeah, that's... I mean...
And if you put the subtitles on, it's capital F.
Yeah, that stuff is deep. That is so deep. I mean, I just can't imagine being in that room and letting that fly.
I can't imagine being in that room and having that even come up as a choice in the first
place. Yeah, it's brutal.
Much less... Yeah, actually saying, yes, this is a good idea. I mean, how many eyes did that pass over that said, yes, leave that in, yes, great?
I know, but it makes perfect sense. If your goal is if you think that there's an audience that's just waiting for, like, four mainstream example, like this is an example of that bottom-down marketing type of thinking. You know.
I don't know.
They put a picture of sports in there to sort of reflect how
the common man plays soccer.
If you're really trying to reach the common man, it totally, like, this totally makes sense, that connecting the gobbledygook Joseph Campbell spirituality of Star Wars to the project of fighting climate change, that makes perfect sense. And especially if you're trying to speak to someone, to yourself at 16 years of age or something, which, you know, we're all doing that to some extent. I mean, at 16 years of age, I understood the Force much better than I understood anarchism or even freedom.
Yeah. And moments before that line, they say something to the effect of, we can all be heroes or something like that.
Yeah.
But the idea of trying to bring people in by saying you're going to be something like a Jedi, which... It's just super strange to me. I mean, that's... In a lot of ways, I think it's sort of alienating, right? Because it's as if to say that there are those among us who are somehow more than human, and we are the ones who are going to bring down the oppression. I mean, that doesn't seem like a very communist sentiment to me. I mean, don't you want to say we're all capable and we can all do these sorts of things, rather than say there are those among us who are heroic and gifted with supernatural powers, are part of an elite select few.
I appreciate that you're willing to truly engage in good faith with something that to me just feels, it's just pandering to a perceived audience that I don't think exists, but, you know, it's a hell of a pander.
Yeah.
Other howlers.
Yeah, I mean, there's another one that I thought was odd. What we must create for ourselves and what they will never have, they being, I guess, the evil people.
The cops.
Is a purpose to fight for and a future to believe in.
Yeah.
I have never been under the impression that the sociopolitical elite do not have a purpose or a future that they believe in. I think they have both of those things way more so than any of the radical milieu out there.
Well, I think that, you know, again, I don't necessarily want to talk about this video for much longer, but I do think that they're speaking to a calculation that I think is a fucking fascinating one. Do we, as people who participate in radical politics, believe that we're the only ones who've read Foucault? That we're the only ones who don't think that the world is good and evil in a ultimate contest? And obviously this statement basically says that you schmucks who are actually targeting here do believe these things that we think are idiotic. Yeah, it just has all this sort of like...
Yeah, you read it as totally cynical.
I mean, perhaps that is because I'm crippled. I'm open to the possibility that I'm crippled as far as...
Your heart is full of sores.
Exactly. That I'm not capable of real freedom.
All right. And then the last howler, I'll just use this as a transition, was, it is urgent that a new historical force rise up.
Comma.
Now.
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 Yeah, that is a lovely one.
Yeah.
It really speaks to sort of a, I mean,
a political failure of not recognizing how ironic that line is, but also just this idea that sort of if we stomp our feet and demand our abstract, arbitrary, very complicated perspectives, then all of a sudden they'll exist. And that doesn't seem like a winning strategy.
And now for the complete opposite.
Yeah, that's true.
We have Desert, which says that there will be no new historical force that rises up.
Yeah.
Or rather, I guess that the new historical force will be an abstract one called climate change.
Right. Yeah, that's true. We are perhaps the theme this week is climate change. Yeah. With the freedom. Yeah. But so for those of you who don't know, Desert was published in 2011. It was an anonymous text, sort of like a small booklet, and
And so, as I said, I just read this over the past 2 days. I think Aragorn read it several years ago.
In 2011.
In 2011. He was very topical at the time. And I think there's a lot to agree with as far as the basic thesis, and there's a lot to appreciate also just that the fact that the book is well researched and is very information dense. And I do wish I'd read this book maybe a few years earlier when it had come out, because at that time, actually, interestingly enough, I was thinking a lot and spent a lot of time reading about these sorts of end of the world scenarios of peak oil and climate change and giant drug-resistant plagues and all that sorts of...
Actually, yeah, to pause, a great sidebar on this is this book does seem to be in dialogue with other green anarchist end-of-the-world scenarios on the point that rather than there being a great catastrophe or a quote-unquote crisis, that instead the end of the world looks like a desert where there's absolutely still life going on. There absolutely is still full biome in place, but it doesn't sort of subscribe to the sort of apocalyptic religious imagery of other green anarchist visions. Go on.
Yeah. And so at that time I was spending a lot of time thinking about that, and that was when I was traveling and looking at a lot of permaculture projects and trying to figure out, okay, like, is there actually going to be a catastrophe? As Aragorn said, what Desert says is we're looking more like this kind of slow, punctuated lurch into a world that is less habitable, that will probably be a lower population, that will have a lot more infrastructural limitations, and that there will be changes, both negative from an anarchist perspective and positive, and also points out something that often doesn't get discussed in climate change catastrophe literature, which is also that a lot of cold places are going to become suddenly more hospitable and will likely be expanded into both by the forces of civilization and people who might be seeking isolation and some measure of relative freedom. And what the author mainly is calling for is a change in perspective, similar actually to the one that we have talked about on this podcast, on probably to some extent in most of the episodes, a sort of sober, perhaps bitter and difficult reflection on what our capacity really is. And the author is saying we cannot stop climate change. There probably will not ever be some sort of great anarchist revolution, that we cannot, it's not really meaningful to talk about saving the world. And instead, what we need to think about is what we can do on a smaller, more specific, individuated, and small group scale. And yeah, I found myself very much in agreement with most of that.
Yeah, I mean, I to put it in a more sort of blunt, topical way, Black Seed is the child of Desert, not the child of, I mean, and perhaps less the child of G.A., but, you know, Desert informed a lot of the thinking behind.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So why don't we talk about your criticisms, then we'll have a discussion.
The part that struck me as odd and felt a bit at odds with the thesis was that there was this kind of endorsement throughout, and even more so toward the end, of a kind of do-anything-ism. And it reminded me a little bit of the way that Derek Jensen talks about things, where he likes to lay out this big case about how bad things are, and then very surprisingly will then say, just the most important thing is that you do something, whether it's blowing up dams or writing your congressperson. And I felt like a bit of that came across in Desert, where the author says toward the end, a lot of the things that we have already been doing as anarchists still make sense to do. In which case you say, well, then why do you see it as so important that we change the perspective? Is it really just a change in attitude that you're calling for rather than a change in activity? And even talks about how in some cases working with government forces or working with rangers in order to stop poachers is something that we might want to do. And that was also confusing. And talking about how international solidarity to save particular wild places still makes sense. But if you take seriously that we're going into a categorically different, long, hot climate shift state, then it seems like all of the wild places are going to change anyway. It doesn't. There's not going to be a meaningful way of preserving a particular biome. And so, yeah, I guess why advance this intense, heavy, unpopular thesis and back it up with all this talk of things that James Lovelock is saying, only to say in the end, it still makes sense for you to do these anarchist things that you've been doing all along. I was expecting significant calls for change in activity as well, like saying it might make sense to get involved in local resilience projects and food systems, or trying to research or anticipate which places are going to get better and worse, or calling for communication networks to start talking about this topic more seriously rather than just leaving it as something for NGOs and states to handle. And so it just was, the claim overall ends up being a bit strange, because it seems like more of a, I want you to change your attitude and stop being such a hopist.
And was that your main criticism?
That was the main one, and then there were other secondary ones that we could talk about.
Well, I'll get into this with you, because I feel like if I were to have restated what it is that you have said, what I would say, and this is me pretending to be Bellamy, is this essay inspired me to write some essays inspired by it about local food sourcing and resilience projects, etc., etc. Or to generalize, some people are good at writing, researching, etc., and others are perhaps better equipped to do activism or food projects or the rest. Like, I actually do not see... I hate articles that begin with a thesis and then end with a action plan or a call to action.
Sure, but the author specifically says a lot of what we're doing right now still makes sense, and then they even close with a Crime Think quote about how we should be anarcho-syndicalists on the factory floor, green anarchists in the woods, individualists when you catch us alone, anarcho-communists when... Mm-hmm. It just comes... It's not the absence of an action plan that is my criticism. It's the implicit action plan that says, keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, again, and to repeat myself, what I hate about most criticism is the way in which it tries to put the problematic somewhere else rather than own it. Or in this case, you need to write the article that you want to see written.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, I think that the criticism that you're making is a fair one that I would make if I knew them personally and mm-hmm. and could have this conversation with them. But I guess I more or less agree with them that if I essentially don't think that anything that human agency is going to make a better world, then do what you're doing, but don't lie to yourself about it. To me, is about as good as I could hope to accomplish in communicating with somebody, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So there's another bit later on where the author specifically advocates exploiting people's foolishness and talks about how many people still believe that we can save the world. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we should use their naivete in order to protect certain wild places.
Right.
That seems odd.
I mean, it's classic environmental thinking, though.
But if you think...
It's even classic political thinking.
Right, but if you think that catastrophic climate change is going to destroy these biomes anyway, then why does it make sense to exploit the foolishness of people, which in itself is questionable, in order to protect something that you think is going to go away?
To you, then, what's a reclamation project to you? Because isn't this just a wildness style reclamation project?
Mm-hmm. A reclamation project. I mean, one thing would be that could be done would be researching what plant species will be able to adapt effectively to mm-hmm. the climate. And so it just seems like it.
But wouldn't that make sense? But wouldn't that make more sense if you're going to argue that the world's going to change no matter what you do? Mm-hmm. But wildness or wild places is going to be a healthier place for that mm-hmm. world to mm-hmm. come from. I mean, there is an argument, I guess.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily make it, but I think that what they're trying to do is they're trying to reorient a green anarchistic perspective
away from conservation and toward adaptation.
Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, but that said, you know, as soon as you play the game of advocating for positive results from projects, you have the complicated mess that you're accusing them of being in, which I think is fair. Mm. Like, I think that in their case, what I would do is not offer this and then sort of be accused of being too abstract. Mm-hmm. In other words, how would you solve this as a writer of a similar themed article?
The dilemma between being programmatic and wrong versus being abstract and right?
Or I haven't read your article on the newest Fifth Estate, which our audience should be aware of. But what's your argument in that piece?
It wasn't making a specific argument. It was something, just the topic I was given the topic. It was not something that I
just big cities. Elected.
It was talking about the mega city project in China. Yeah. And the thesis is it's bad.
I'm not convinced.
and there is no program. Yeah.
What's the article called? Mega cities, right?
Mm, I wanted to call it something else.
Which was?
The human CAFO. Right, concentrated right. Animal feeding operation. Yeah. And that was too weird or too nerdy or yeah. something.
Pretty nerdy.
It was pretty nerdy. It was definitely coming from the old vegan days.
Well, next week we should talk about Alejandro's article.
Yeah, we didn't interact that much this week. I was going to suggest that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we can. I'll come back and talk more about desert and consider your criticism of my criticism.
Well, let's.
Is there more to discuss? You go down. Oh yeah, those.
I think that this question of exploiting people's weaknesses or stupidity is interesting. It speaks to the author's origin. So I do know who the author is. I know where their political orientation comes from, but I don't know them personally. I think that, that idea of thinking about international ecological stuff in the way that they do and that discussion about people's stupidity is almost a hallmark of coming out of the anti-globalization era, where radical activists were being heard by NGOs that had money. And I have absolutely no experience with that kind of work or that kind of thinking, and so I can't even imagine like any context in which I would sit in the room or be at the table for any of these sort of high level negotiations, but that ultimately involve dollars being converted into activism units. And and so in that way, I just don't understand the author at all. There's currently a person who very much inhabits a space between Crime Think and Tikkun and all the rest, who's absolutely a player even today in NGO sort of politics. And I know that there are dozens of these people, but I know this one in particular. And anytime they start to talk about, like, you know, basically being in the room and setting the standards by which, you know, computers communicate with each other, they totally lose me. I could not reconcile any of that dialogue I just used with an anarchism that I felt like was a projectual anarchism. And this is a place where the author of this essay is thinking on a level that I am just not willing to do. And I'm curious how many people in the U.S. are thinking in that way.
So next week we will talk a little bit more about desert or some responses to desert.
Yeah.
And other things.
Okay. And feel free to contact us at thebrilliant@thebrilliant.org. Next week we'll do a bit more listener feedback. We actually got quite a few emails asking us to talk about this, that, and the other. And thank you very much for joining us. Talk to you soon.